Hello, and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, we're pleased to welcome Michael Hatton as a new commentator for the podcast series. Michael is a faculty member of Pardes, specializing in Chumash, and he holds a BA in architecture from the University of Toronto. Michael is currently completing his smicha at Yeshivat Haaretz Zion's Advanced Talmudic College. And now, Michael Hatton.
Thank you, Larry. As the Book of Shemot draws to a close, the account of the Mishkan is completed. It had been initially described in the Parshiyot of Truma and Tetzaveh, when God first spelled out to Moshe the vessels, building elements, and priestly garments to be fashioned. The matter is now revisited in the Parshiyot of Vayakel and Pekudei, as Moshe conveys God's commands to Israel and the actual work is then executed. The Torah begins the account of the fabrication by noting that Moshe's call for a contribution of all of the necessary materials, precious metals, rare dyes and textiles, animal hides and wood, fine oils and spices and gemstones, was munificently answered by the entire people of Israel. The entire congregation of Israel left Moshe's presence. Every man whose heart moved him, everyone whose spirit inspired him, brought a contribution for God for the fashioning of the tent of meeting and all of its vessels, and for the sacred vestments. Every woman wise of heart spun with her hands, and they brought the sky blue, purple, crimson, and linen. The tribal princes brought the onyx stones and the gemstones for setting in the ephod and the breastplate. Every man and woman whose heart moved them to contribute materials for the fashioning of all of the things that God commanded Moshe to be wrought, the people of Israel brought as a freewill offering to God. The undertaking is thus national in scope. No man or woman, no prince or pauper, no commoner or noble was excluded. How could it be otherwise? The house of God, if it is to radiate the immediate experience of His presence into the world, if it is to truly enrich our lives and charge them with purpose and meaning, cannot be an exclusive and extravagant imposition of the priesthood, or else a stark and severe refuge of the insular ascetics, but rather the house of all Israel. Recall that the Mishkan, or divine abode, consists of four major elements: a sacred and curtained enclosure, a prefabricated building positioned within it, specific vessels placed within the spaces, and particular precious garments to be worn by the officiating clergy. The entire complex, rectangular in plan, and hence directional in character, is sited along an east-west axis, with access from the east. The progression through the spaces is hierarchical and marked by real or implied portals. As the worshipper or priest moves from the camp of Israel, through the courtyard, into the building proper, and towards the serene impenetrability of the Holy of Holies. The various vessels have a ritual utility and readily comprehensible functionality that is, however, invariably bound up with a more profound symbolism. At first glance, although the general purpose of the Mishkan is readily apparent, we can detect no biblical precedents for the building or for its vessels. There are no obvious references elsewhere in the Torah that might inspire an ark or table, menorah or golden altar, bronze altar or laver, a ephod or breastplate. Their introduction in the sections of Teruma and Tetzaveh seems at once original and extraordinary. It is true that at Sinai there was sacrifice, as Moshe erected an altar at the feet of the mountain in the aftermath of the revelation of the Decalogue, and there the people swore their allegiance to God's laws. But the only overt connections between Sinai's altar of unhewn stones and the bronze altar of the tabernacle are the similar ceremonial acts and spiritual sentiments that inspire them both, rather than any tangible or empirical qualities. It is also true that the Ramban detects a powerful general association between the tabernacle and Mount Sinai, between the ongoing revelation to Moshe and to Israel in the wilderness and the climactic event of the giving of the Torah at Horeb, for he perceptively indicates that a similar vocabulary of preparation on the one hand and maintaining a solemn distance on the other informs them both. At Sinai, Israel was commanded to remain respectfully far from the mountain's perimeter, while being simultaneously sensitive to God's overwhelming presence. That singular manifestation of His presence sanctified the location in space and the moment in time, and created the necessity for the people's prior purification. For the Ramban, the Mishkan is meant to not only duplicate that experience, but to perpetuate it forever. Thus the tabernacle constitutes a sacred enclosure in which we may encounter God's immediacy, but entry is barred to all, save those who prepare ahead of time. From within the tabernacle, God communicates His will to Moshe, just as He did at Mount Sinai. Nevertheless, Ramban makes no attempt to link most of the specifics of the Mishkan with Mount Sinai, because the more intrinsic connection between the two consists in the broader idea of the God-man encounter. Perhaps then there is no need to uncover an obvious correspondence between, say, the menorah and what happened at Sinai, because the menorah and its kind are divinely ordained vehicles that, taken together, can facilitate the experience of God. But could the lampstand not be acting as the precious repository of the flame and fire that blazed at its summit that night? As instruments of the service, the vessels and their building envelope are the means that allow the Sinai encounter to be relived, and that constitutes their most authentic connection to the event. The one exception for the Ramban seems to be the Ark of the Testimony, or the Aron, for in it he detects a direct reference to God's angelically appointed throne, and hence the expression of His ongoing presence and involvement in the material world. Through the vehicle of the Aron, God speaks to Moshe and thus communicates His glorious will to Israel, just as He revealed His holy words to the prophet from Sinai's smoking summit. What, then, might be the sources for these curious vessels, for the sacred enclosure, for the all-encompassing complex that contains them? Considering the matter in its entirety, the Ramban's interpretation still fresh in our minds, there is at first only one single word that can perhaps guide us in our investigation, although admittedly the reference may seem at first overly tenuous. Recall that the Ark of the Testimony, the chest-like container for the tablets of the Decalogue, consisted of a wooden box covered inside and out with pure gold. Like the other vessels, it was provided with four golden rings on its sides, and appointed with staves of overlaid acacia wood so that it could be conveyed from place to place. But the most unusual feature of the vessel was its golden top that was surmounted by the two winged figures known as Kiruvim, or to use the equally obscure translation, cherubs. Traditional sources envision these figures to possess an almost childlike appearance, but many other biblical references make it abundantly clear that they were meant to represent, in the coarse material terms that humans possessed of bodies must use, angelic creatures. These Kruvim occur in many later sources as the harbingers of the divine presence, and hence are associated with the notion of sovereign God's throne and His concomitant involvement in the material world. In similar terms, both the Ramban as well as the Sforno understood their inclusion here, and in this way they explained the special prominence that is accorded the Kiruvim as they dramatically alight upon the lid of the Ark of Testimony. It was as if God's presence in the material world was predicated upon Israel's allegiance to His laws and teachings. The tablets of the Decalogue safeguarded in the golden chest that was the Aron. It was as if God's majesty, symbolized by the Auric throne, could only hold sway over the human heart that had itself sought out His teaching and instruction, the heart that was sensitive to the call of the still small voice emanating to Moshe at the infinitesimal point in space between the outstretched wings of the Kruvim. As the verses themselves indicate, the Kruvim shall have outstretched wings upwards. Upwards they shall cover the lid with their wings, and they shall face each other as they gaze towards the lid. You shall place the lid above upon the ark above, and within the ark you shall place the testimony that I will give you. I will encounter you there, and I will speak to you from upon the lid. From in between the two Kiruvim that are upon the Ark of the Testimony, all that I will command you to convey to the people of Israel. Significantly, there is only one other passage in the entire Chumash, besides the tabernacle narratives, that mentions the Kiruvim, though admittedly it is but a fleeting reference. Nevertheless, it may be sufficient to provide us with the antecedents for which we have been searching. The context of that reference is a suitably charged moment, the immediate aftermath of Adam and Eve having abrogated the only divine command that he had placed upon them: eat the fruit of all the trees of the garden, but do not eat of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, for on that day that you eat from it, you shall surely die. The two humans, partners in body, companions in crime, do not succeed in long resisting the wiles of the crafty serpent, and soon partake of the forbidden fruit. Immediately they experience the elation of absolute autonomy, and then the shame of its wanton exercise, and unsuccessfully they attempt to hide themselves from God's presence. The existential tension reaches its acme as God suggestively calls out, "Where are you?" But his invitations to each of them in turn to acknowledge culpability and thus effect sincere tshuva are rebuffed. And thus it is that they are expelled from Eden, lest they utilize their newly functional moral freedom to partake of the cryptic tree of life and thus achieve immortality. The passage relates, "God, Lord, sent them forth from the Garden of Eden to work the earth from which they had been formed. He expelled the human, and he placed the Kruvim east of Eden, along with the blade of the whirling sword, to guard the path to the tree of life." The above passage is, of course, inscrutable in the extreme and raises many troubling and profound questions. But for our purposes at the present time, let us overlook these issues and instead focus upon the textual details. Adam and Chava are banished from paradise and forced to extract their sustenance from the unyielding earth. The path of return is effectively barred as the Kruvim are placed to the east, where these curious creatures stand as threatening sentinels to guard the approach to the isolated tree of life. It does not require a great leap of the imagination to immediately recognize that the scheme of the expulsion from Eden closely parallels the spatial organization of the Mishkan. In both situations, the precious object, be it the Ark of the Testimony or else the Tree of Life, is set off in an at once focal and yet secluded space, with the movement towards it effectively restricted by the imposing visages of the angels. In both cases, the primary axis of approach is from the east, for all of the filtering thresholds of the tabernacle and of its enclosure are traversed from that direction, while the threatening Kruvim with their flaming swords guard the garden from the east. In both episodes, it is the experience of God's immediacy that is at stake. For at Eden, Adam and Chava were driven from it, while at the tabernacle we seek it with intense longing. There are two other indications that reinforce this preliminary reading, one of them textual and the other exegetical. First of all, we note that God's placing of the Kruvim east of Eden involves the verb shachan. He expelled the human, and he placed the Kruvim east of Eden. Vayashken mikedem ligan Eden et ha-Kruvim, along with the blade of the whirling sword. Vayashken is, of course, the very same unusual root from which Mishkan, or God's abode, is derived, reinforcing the link between the events at Eden and the later fashioning of his sanctuary. Secondly, while the Torah leaves out any rational explanation for the Tree of Life, cloaking it in the very same profound obscurity that informs the remainder of the Eden narrative, later biblical tradition drew some evocative associations. The term occurs only four other times outside of the garden, all of them in the book of Mishle, or Proverbs, authored by Shlomo, the very same king who built the first temple during his reign. And admittedly, all of these other references use the term without the definite article, but the connection to our Mishkan context, especially in one of the citations, is nevertheless unmistakable. The text in Mishle relates, "Do not refuse God's instruction, my son, and do not reject his admonition. For God rebukes the one whom he loves as a father desires his son. Happy is the man who has found wisdom, the person who has achieved understanding, for its value is greater than silver, and its bounty exceeds pure gold. It is more precious than pearls, and none of your possessions can compare to it. Length of days is on its right, wealth and honor on its left. Its ways are ways of pleasantness, and all of its paths are peaceful. Eitz chayim hi lemachazikim ba, v'tomcheha miushar. It is a tree of life to those who grasp it, and those who support it are exultant. The above passage is an ode to wisdom, praising the value of understanding and the importance of accepting God's instruction and guidance. Though his teaching must sometimes involve reprimand and reproach, it must be understood as similar to the constructive criticism that any loving parent must occasionally bestow upon the errant child. Nothing is more precious than achieving self-awareness, spiritual maturity, and understanding of God, and no material possessions can match their value. The Torah, literally God's instruction, sustains us, for it is a tree of life for all those who hold on to it. Who could fail to see the early history of humanity spelled out in this passage? The first human beings, who rejected God's loving rebuke and hence forfeited their hold on the very tree of life that now beckoned inaccessible from beyond the leafy portals of Eden, who would not now recognize the obvious implication that the Mishkan, repository of the Kiruv-flanked Ark of the Testimony and its sustaining instruction for living, the two tables of the Decalogue, as well as the pledge of his ongoing communication to man of his will, is but a microcosm of the garden, its golden elements, an idealized representation of the potential for God's immediacy that Israel might still achieve by holding fast to his Torah. Having established the Mishkan-Eden association, it now remains to strengthen the argument by drawing other parallels between the two, before going on to investigate the more profound implications of the link. Perhaps we should begin by listing some of the other elements found in each of the respective worlds, the world of the garden and the world of the sanctuary. At Eden, of course, there was the Tree of Knowledge, an enigmatic denizen of the garden with most unusual qualities. Those that partook of its fruit could know good and evil. Of all of the trees of the garden, only the Tree of Knowledge was proscribed by divine fiat. God commanded the man, saying, "Of all of the trees of the garden you may surely eat, but of the Tree of Knowledge of good and evil you may not eat it, for on the day that you eat from it, you shall surely die." As for the garden itself, the Torah describes it as a pleasant and fertile place, full of beautiful trees and delicious fruits, well watered by four proverbial rivers, and even adorned with prized gold, rubies, and onyx. How auspicious for man to have been placed by God in that garden, to work its black soil, and to guard its contents, to exercise responsible stewardship over its bounty, and to live in blessed concord with the earth and all of creation. Life in the garden was, of course, ennobled by other less worldly qualities, by the immediate and ongoing experience of God's overarching presence. In that garden, God's closeness was manifest, his spirit sustaining, his nurturing words not a heartbeat away. No wonder the later prophetic works would draw on the idyllic vision of the Garden of Eden to describe the perfect state of affairs that they proclaimed would one day transform our wounded world at the dawn of the Messianic era. We have already drawn the obvious connection between the Tree of Life and the Ark of the Testimony, both of them sources of eternity, both zealously guarded in the most inaccessible of spaces by the fiery Kiruvim. The Mishkan proper, the building in contrast to its surrounding enclosure, contained other prominent vessels, the table, the menorah, and the golden altar as well. The approach to the building was marked by the bronze laver, a large ornamental container of water from which the officiating priests would wash before performing their service. In the courtyard was the large altar of bronze, and upon it the animal sacrifices were offered. And everywhere, of course, from the ornamental curtains to the gilded Mishkan walls, from the various vessels to the priestly garments, was the sight of scarlet, sky blue and purple, the gleam of gold, the scent of precious spices and fragrant oils, and the sparkle of precious stones. While we may not succeed at establishing plausible links between all of these vessels in the garden, there are, however, some unmistakable parallels. The menorah is described in the Torah as a seven-branched candelabrum. Significantly, though, in its detailed description of this object that literally means a vessel of light, the Torah unmistakably employs a lexicon drawn from the world of plants and flowers. Not only does the golden lamp have seven branches, but also those branches are ornamented with representations of calyxes, almond blossoms, knops, and flowers. Fashioned out of a single piece of solid gold, the menorah resembles nothing so much as a tree, an organic tree of light. Light, of course, in our culture, as well as in many others, is a powerful metaphor for enlightenment. No wonder the classic commentaries, chief among them the Abarbanel in the 15th century and the Sforno as well, understood the menorah as a symbol for wisdom and spirituality, as a metaphor for the interrelated branches of human knowledge that ultimately all derive from the one absolute intelligence. No wonder that the traditional sources, with no textual proof to support their contention, all maintained that the menorah was also provided with three sturdy legs. If the menorah was a kind of tree, then these three limbs were its roots, securely anchoring it to the fertile ground of the Mishkan, from whence alone it could draw its sustenance. In other words, the menorah was the idealized tree of knowledge from Eden, no longer a source of failure and frustration, a divinely prohibited attraction that could not be resisted, but rather a source of inspiration and understanding. The transformation from the one into the other could only be accomplished by a singular transformation of the human heart. By the menorah's golden light, God called upon man to seek wisdom and knowledge, to exercise human reason and intelligence, not as a selfish goal honed by his destructive appetite for domination and self-deification, but rather as a humbling yet lofty pursuit, a responsible means of repairing the world. In other words, to use our intellect and acumen in God's service rather than to banish him, and with him all vestiges of human conscience and moral awareness, knowledge of good and evil, from our lives. As we saw last time, the table of the showbread was an expression of God's providence. Our physical sustenance, the preservation of our bodies and our health, depends upon food, the proverbial bread that every civilization celebrates in one form or another as the staple and the staff of life. The 12 loaves upon the table indicated that the entire people of Israel, the 12 tribes, drew their livelihood from God above, who alone could be depended upon to provide. According to rabbinic tradition, though the loaves remained on the table all week long, only being replaced from one Shabbat to the next, they remained miraculously fresh, as flavorsome as at the moment that they had been carefully removed from the oven. In this way, the loaves indicated that God's providence was always manifest, his saving sustenance never absent or spent. Thus it was that the table of showbread, as symbol of physical providence, provided the perfect analog to God's ongoing and spiritual and intellectual inspiration, the golden menorah that stood just opposite it in the holy space of the Mishkan. The ideal of the table was clearly an echo of the blessed state of Eden, in which one's satiation was never more than a redolent tree branch away. The fruits of Eden were always ripe, their taste never stale, because God's presence was in the garden. Recall that man was placed in the garden to work it and to guard it. But as the Ramban already perceptively noted in his commentary, God placed him there to plant wheat and grains, grass and spices, to harvest, pluck, and consume at his leisure, for the trees of the garden really required no care. How significant indeed that when they were driven out, their pastoral existence was transmuted by his curse, that by the sweat of your brow you shall eat bread, as toil, drudgery, and exertion now colored the pursuit that had once been called only work. The table, then, was once again the chance to make amends, to restore the perfect state by ascribing to God what was His. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. I am God, your Lord, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. Stretch your mouth wide, and I will fill it. You open your hand and satiate the desire of all manner of life. We could continue to draw many additional parallels. What were the acacia planks of the tabernacle that the text insisted had to be placed standing, or as the Talmud relates, after the manner of their growth, if not the trees of the garden? For God, Lord, caused the earth to grow every kind of tree that was beautiful to behold and good to eat. What were the precious materials, the fine gold and precious jewels of the vessels and the vestments, if not the fantastic landscape of Eden? Even the shoham, the onyx stones of the garden, found their place upon the epaulets of the high priest. What was the polished bronze laver of the forecourt, if not the suggestion of the four life-giving rivers that watered the garden continuously, now abstracted as the means of sanctification before entering the holy precinct? But most telling of all, what was the implication of the high priest, bedecked in his golden finery and adorned with the names of the God of Israel, if not the suggestion of the first man Adam, who had once stood in his presence and hearkened to his voice? In a remarkable formulation first advanced by Sadia Gaon, the Ibn Ezra maintains that while the world at large had humanity, and the human microcosm had the heart, the Mishkan had the high priest as an analog. The high priest, then, was the potent symbol of humanity's potential. What was possible if man could only deign to live his life in the life-giving shadow of God's constant care? In the conceptual world of the Mishkan, the service of the high priest, who, try as he might, could never lose sight of his God-appointed task, was the return of humanity to the garden and to its overwhelming landscape of continuous divine intimacy. To enter the holy precincts of the tabernacle was to finally confront the Kruvim east of Eden and to claim our rightful place before the Tree of Life. I would like to conclude with a passage from the prophet Yechezkel, who flourished in Babylon as Jerusalem and the first temple were turned to ash. In his mind's eye, Yechezkel sees a brighter future for the people of Israel, a time when they will be restored to their land, to their city, and to their God. Though the metaphors that he employs are not exclusive to him, but find expression in the messianic visions of many a prophet of Israel, Yechezkel's words are particularly poignant and help us draw the parallel not only between the Garden of Eden and the Mishkan, but also between the Garden of Eden and the future temple. One day, united humanity will be inspired to sincerely serve the God of Israel, and the temple at Jerusalem will finally become the gathering place for all people to learn of his ways. Yechezkel relates, "He returned me to the entrance of the house, and behold, water emerged from under its eastern threshold, for the entrance to the house was from the east. The water descended from under the right slope of the house, south of the altar. At a distance of 1,000 cubits, I went through water that was ankle deep. He measured a further 1,000, and I traversed knee-deep waters. He measured a further 1,000, and I went through waist-deep waters. He measured a further 1,000, and the waters became a torrent that I could not pass, for the waters rose up at swimming height, a stream that could not be traversed. He said to me, 'Do you see it, son of man?' as he caused me to walk and approach the banks of the stream. When I returned, I saw that on either side of the banks of the stream were a multitude of trees. He said to me, 'These waters go out to the eastern regions and descend to the plain. They will go out to the Dead Sea and heal its waters. All manner of life that swarms there will live, and its fish will be numerous, for these waters will flow there and heal and enliven all that contact them at the stream. The fishermen will stand on its banks from Ein Gedi to Ein Eglaim, and spread wide their nets. For the fish shall be as numerous as the fish of the great Mediterranean Sea. Its swamps and hollows will not be healed, for they shall provide salt. On either bank of the stream shall be all manner of fruit trees, whose leaves shall never wither, whose fruits shall never fail, that monthly will yield their new produce, for their waters come from the holy temple. Their fruits shall be for food, and their leaves for healing. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Michael. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated. Please send your emails to podcast@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.